Today's conversation is with the legendary activist Tom Hayden. Tom Hayden was a leader of the student, civil rights, peace, and environmental movements of the 1960s. He went on to serve 18 years in the California legislature. He was a founder of Students for a Democratic Society and was described by the New York Times as, quote, the single greatest figure of the 1960s student movement. During the Vietnam War, Tom Hayden made controversial trips to Hanoi with his former wife, actress Jane Fonda, to promote peace talks and facilitate the release of American prisoners of war. He helped lead street demonstrations against the war at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, where he was beaten, gassed, and arrested twice. Hayden was indicted in 1969 with seven others on conspiracy and incitement charges on what became the Chicago 8 trial, considered one of the leading political trials of the last century. Tom Hayden is now director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, California. He organizes, travels, and speaks on a variety of issues. He helps advise Governor Jerry Brown on renewable energy, and he's the author and editor of 20 books. His current one, just released, is called Why Cuba Matters. Tom Hayden is now 75 years old. I caught up with him last week at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where Hayden was speaking at the 50th anniversary of the first Vietnam War teach-in held on a U.S. college campus. I began by asking him to explain what Students for a Democratic Society was.
Well, we're in Ann Arbor in the University of Michigan, close to the hallowed ground where SDS was formed by a small group of students who were inspired by the Black Student Sit-In Movement and Freedom Rider Movement in the Deep South, beginning as a wave of arrests and direct action in 1960. We were feeling this desire to act or become something, and the alternative before us was kind of boring classroom lectures on the one hand, followed by boring jobs, or craziness represented by all of our other heroes, the poem Howl, the novel Holden Caulfield, Ken Kesey's novels. They were all about people who were mad. And we wanted a way to act out without going mad. We wanted, and we thought this idea of putting your body on the line and figuring out a way to change and end racism and empower young people was such a blessing. It opened the way, and we wanted to keep it going. And so we called ourselves Students for a Democratic Society because that's really all we wanted. But it was participatory, whether it was in your home or universities or in voting. We wrote a manifesto here in 61, 62. That took off. Everybody wanted to read it, and we formed chapters, and everything moved so rapidly and unexpectedly when the Vietnam War began.
So let me cut in there. We're at the University of Michigan on the 50th anniversary of the very first teach-in that occurred on an American college campus. You were here then. What was the experience of that very first teach-in at the University of Michigan?
Well, we were kind of caught off balance. We thought that the war would not expand, and we were going to go from the campus to work in ghettos and barrios and in Appalachia to organize poor people and working people the way that SNCC, the students, had done in the South, all together now, forward. And instead, Johnson, to our shock, said he was not going to send us to Vietnam, and then immediately he did. So January of that year, 65, draft. No student today can imagine what it was like to have a draft notice. If you were a guy or a woman, the idea that all of us were arbitrarily being snatched to go to Vietnam made no sense. And so we had basic questions like, why do presidents lie? Where is Vietnam? why are we taking over a war that the French just lost after 100 years? Why are we sending troops there, but we won't send federal marshals to protect the right to vote in Mississippi? Why can't we vote for politicians, but they can draft us and send us to fight? These kind of questions led to the idea of a teach-in. We didn't have a word for it, but somebody, I was already in Newark, New Jersey, somebody said, we have to stop business as usual in the university and think and engage and demand the government to come here and tell us what their idea is, and we have to develop an alternative idea, and that's going to have to be resistance, opposition, protest. So it started as a small group. Some people wanted to strike and close the university down. Others said, no, that's premature. We need to think. So we called it a teach-in, like a sit-in. And I remember coming from Newark, it's not that far, and sitting in this hall that we're in, Angel Hall, and several thousand students sat all night, and lecturers talked all night, and students asked questions. And then it spread to Berkeley and got bigger. And then in a week or two, it had gone national. There was a teach-in on the radio, a hookup. I forget what it was called technically then. You may know. But it went all over the country. And it was the opening of a effort at citizens taking foreign policy back to examine before they gave their sons' lives or gave their personal lives to any dubious cause like the Vietnam War. And then it coupled with draft resistance, which gave it an action edge. And we were off. And we had, in April of that same year, the first demonstration in Washington. SDS called it. 25,000 people came. It's been described in every history book as the biggest peace march up to that point that anyone had recorded. It was only 25,000 people. We were overwhelmed. We couldn't imagine that many people coming, but it had a spontaneity to it. A combination of lies, the draft, and nobody knowing what we were being drafted for, plus the civil rights spirit.
One of the watershed moments in the history of the 60s that you played a leading role in was the trial of the Chicago Eight. Can you recount what led to that trial and what it was, why it became sort of the political trial of the century?
Well, that was years later, 1968. Things escalated fast. When you're being drafted and a war is on, things have a way of speeding beyond your comprehension. The short of it is that the administration, as it became the Nixon administration, seemed to go back. They were prisoners of their own past, and they believed that we were a subversive threat and we could be stopped the way McCarthyism stopped the left in the early 50s when Nixon was vice president. That was to prosecute a cross-section of symbolic figures. So you had a Black Panther, two yippies who were the political version of the hippies, three anti-war, and two graduate students. Not all of us knew each other, but that's not necessary to be convicted of a conspiracy. And the conspiracy was to disrupt the Democratic Convention. A commission later found that it was a police riot. That's too long a story to tell, but it gripped the media and the nation, and we were then put on trial by Nixon, and the trial itself was televised. Not all the time, it was televised a lot. The drawings were by a famous cartoonist for the Village Voice named Jules Pfeiffer. And we were convicted. Two were innocent, and five of us were
Recall the names of everyone.
Well, there was John Freund and Lee Weiner were released of all charges. Bobby Seale, the chairman of the Black Panther Party, was facing a murder conspiracy charge in Connecticut, so he was in and out of our trial. He got thrown out of our trial at the time for speaking out because he didn't have a lawyer, and he said he had a constitutional right to have a lawyer. The judge couldn't comprehend a black man doing this, so he was locked in chains and brought into the courtroom, tied to a chair by chains with a gag around his mouth. When I tell that story today, people say it's an exaggeration. Or when it's filmed in a movie, people say, well, some of that is artistic license. That surely didn't happen. But it did. He eventually got off all charges as well. Then there was a leading Quaker pacifist, nonviolent person, David Dellinger,
who lived his later years in Vermont.
He was more middle-aged. Yes, he lived into his 90s, thanks to Vermont water, or Vermont weather, I guess. There was Rennie Davis, who was my closest associate, a really great organizer of mass mobilizations, came out of Oberlin. There was Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who were the Yippies. They had been active in the New Left, and they decided that the youth culture was sort of where it was at, and they thought they could politicize it by calling themselves Yippies, the Youth International Party, which was a figment of their fevered imagination, but in the way they viewed things, as long as it was a media creation, it was real, and you could act out on television and electrify and interest a lot of young people across the country. Who knows if they were right or wrong, but it made for great television coverage. Then there was Bill Kunstler and Leonard Weinglass, great lawyers who suffered a lot of crossfire between the defendants and the judge. Both of them were given lengthy contempt citations, and at the end of the trial, we had to fight for bail, then we had to appeal, which we won in 2 years, and then we had to go back to trial for contempt, and we got off 99% of the contempt charges. And that was at the time the war was ending and Nixon was crumbling, and I think that atmosphere probably helped us. We were found to be falsely sent to jail, and the people who were accusing us were themselves being impeached and thrown out of office or put in jail, like the attorney, some of the Watergate figures. So it came out to have an odd sort of happy ending.
So you went on, we're skipping over a lot of details, some very famous trips that you and your second wife, Jane Fonda, took to North Vietnam during the war that... But moving ahead, you then entered electoral politics. For 18 years, you were a member of the California legislature. What made you decide to try to seek change from the inside?
Yeah, it's 2015, and that was 20 years ago, by the way, so we'll have to speed this conversation up. I'm like an archaeological dig. I had 20 years in electoral politics, and that was a long time ago. I think it was the climate of the times seemed so favorable. Remember, I started as a student editor and a voter registration activist and a community organizer who couldn't vote. I was involved in Newark in electing candidates who became the successful candidates that overturned white rule and installed a black mayor after I had left. The idea of the Mississippi Freedom Summer was to elect people across Mississippi to challenge the Democratic Party, and some of them became, like Benny Thompson, became members of the Congress. So the idea of electoral politics was not foreign. It was logical to the SDS in 60, 62, in that period, 64. So when the trial was over, I remember sitting around a camp with a bunch of friends deciding what we might want to do with the next 10 years of our lives. Literally true. We'd given 10 or 15 years to Vietnam, and we were in our 30s. So couple people wanted to work in the Ralph Nader networks of citizen action. One woman wanted to work in organizing woman office workers and unionize them and get them into the AFL-CIO. I don't really remember quite if there was an environmental impulse. It was just budding, but the citizen action people were of that mind. I wanted to try to run in a Democratic primary to get the largest mandate I could, kind of exonerating all of us through the vote to show that we were legitimate and had a right to a voice and a vote in our society. So I had, it was crazy. I ran for the U.S. Senate, which you don't do with beginning from nothing. But I did get into the 40% range in the Democratic primary. There was 1.3 million Democratic votes. That's more than Eugene Debs for president in the whole country. We won Santa Barbara County. We won Humboldt County. We won some areas. And we started an organization, since I still was not sure whether I was a politician. We tried to use the campaign to launch a campaign for greater democracy over economic and energy issues. I campaigned on a platform of solar energy. By then I was all in. This was 75, 76. And so I didn't really commit to electoral office until I ran in 82, 4 years later, after having built this organizational network. And then I wound up, I don't mean to make it sound like a prison sentence, but I served 18 years. And not many people, John Lewis comes to mind, but not many people had my background and were in government. And it's a lonely experience.
Why was it lonely?
Well, because people would look at you weird, like, that's Tom Hayden. He's Jane Fonda's husband. He went to jail for trying to overthrow the government. Now he's here. So the Republicans immediately launched a recall effort to deny me a seat, what the Georgia legislature did to Julian Bond. They tried it twice, and I was retained in my elected office by the Democratic majority by like a margin of 4 votes. So it took them some getting used to me after trying to repel me. It was not exactly a welcome to the mainstream experience. I was always that way. I was like, I was a, quote, celebrity and an oddball and a suspected revolutionary in their midst. And the only thing I could do was try to continue organizing. One of the values that I don't think you have in Vermont, but in those days, a Senate seat in California meant you had 15 full-time staff and 2 offices. So I could hire 15 organizers. I hired 4X gang members, for example, to work on inner city social justice. I had the most polyglot, you talk about diversity. I mean, I had more diversity on my staff than I've ever seen. Certainly the Capitol has ever seen. Gays before their time, Filipinos, 20-year-old students in charge of educational policy. And I worked. I love the work. It's kind of like your work. It's investigative reporting, but you have a subpoena power, and you can call witnesses. You can go and be an eyewitness to something, and then to stick it to the establishment, you can introduce a bill, and they have to deal with it. And if it gets through a committee, you just keep going. And each time you have a hearing, more people get interested. I found it as a very good organizing tool, even though I served mainly under Republican governors. But it was also lonely because I didn't have that many partners. There weren't other people who, nobody in their right mind was going to hire somebody out of prison. Most people thought the role of staff is to give out celebratory plaques to community members in exchange for political support, or do press releases to extol your latest legislation, not to go out and disturb the peace and rouse people up and get them. I even tried to run a statewide organizing project on voter registration to get Democratic turnout up. I thought it was a service to the party caucus. It started, we started doing the work, and all of a sudden members of my own party in the caucus started complaining to the speaker, what's Hayden doing in my district? I wasn't in the district, but it was the Haydenistas. Why are they registering people in my district? So I found it took a long time to see the limits. I kept running into invisible walls, but nevertheless, I was also felt that I was carving out space, that I was getting territory and resources, and at the same time being blocked. If it had been a different president, a different governor, I don't know, but I was dealt the hand that you get dealt in some of these situations.
So talk about today. What is the Vietnam War for you of today, the thing that you think you need to disturb the peace about most?
Well, some people say that climate is the binding issue. I would say we have become so diverse. Our multiplicity is our greatest weakness and our greatest strength. And so the idea that there's one thing escapes me. Yes, you have to make a priority, but what I find is you're never going to unify people if you don't respect what they consider is their fundamental identity or priority. Just not going to unify them unless they're at the table, they're part of it. That is a value of presidential campaigns or electoral campaigns because they're temporary and you can bring diverse people together to show their strength and they relate to each other and they get something out of it. They wind up with a bigger base, more signatures, maybe they're elected to a local office and then they fade, whether it's the Nader campaign or the Hayden for Senate campaign, or the Obama campaign. I always see that within the campaign, the grassroots, there's always a new wave of people who, for whatever reasons, they love the campaign and they get into it, like hundreds of thousands. And then what's next? And some become lifetime activists as a result. Some go into politics, some don't. But it's a unifier. If you try to unify around an issue, it would probably have to be the loathing of someone, like Johnson, people really loathed, or Nixon, people really loathed, or Bush, and that too will bring people together in their loathing, but it's not an agenda. I wish there was a grassroots party of the left under our system that could be involved in the Democratic Party and occasionally in Republican politics and not lose its status. But the way our system is set up, except in New York where you have that Working Families Party, it's either you have to be a third party where you have a lot of liabilities or a Democratic Party where you're lost in the crowd, and I prefer a party that works on all levels but has some coherence, some progressive platform that would address the main issues, which obviously are the transition from the fossil fuel economy to renewables and conservation, the transition from militarism and counterterrorism to diplomacy and coexistence, and the transition from a kind of an oligopoly of economic power to a living wage for the world that would be enforceable by international law, with the living wage and union movements here combined with Latin America and elsewhere. Because I do think people in general respond to demands. They say, what do you want? Anarchists don't agree with me. But if you always have a community organizer approach and you're trying to reach new people who are not affected, I find they usually, if you come at them with a placard or you're protesting, they ask the simple question, what do you want? What do I get? What is it? What's for our community? So having demands that are repeated and are backed up by logic and argument, I think, are useful. And you also can measure whether you're gaining ground towards the achievement of those demands. I love the idea that there's a dozen or 15 living wage ordinances. It's not much, the far left would say. That's right. You know, but I remember working in Newark, people would take a dollar wage increase, big deal. And you can build on that. So that's what I would prefer. But to expect coherence from the left, I think we first have to address sectarianism and division. And if we ever get to the other side of those problems, maybe we'll get to coherence. I don't know.
In 2008, you formed a group or headed a group called Progressives for Obama. What's your assessment of President Obama?
Getting better. I followed very closely the Cuba stuff, and it was based on my... I sort of go by the thought that what he stood for early is what lies underneath all the crap that he has to go through as president, with the Congress, with the daily 24-hour media, with world events. So I thought he wanted to normalize relations with Cuba, and I cut him slack on how long it would take because he's got to make those calls. But I've been watching since 2013 and with certainty that he and Raul were going to normalize relations before Raul was out of office and Obama was out of office. So, you know, anybody that says he's the same as the Republicans has got to ask, is it really true of Obama versus the Cuban-American lobby in Florida and New Jersey, the Republicans who've been attacking the island for 55 years? Is there really no difference? Come on. Get serious. On immigrant rights, I was 100% certain he was going to move on immigrant rights. There were people demanding that he move faster, and they called him the deporter-in-chief, and I thought that was over the top, but predictable. The anger is predictable. He did follow through. He did need a movement to do it. And look at the opposition. It's unbelievable. We're not even getting close to a path to citizenship. It's all very precarious, but at least maybe 5 or 10 million people have some protection from being snatched and deported, and maybe they'll be able to unionize with green cards, and maybe they'll be able to drive a car. Look at Obamacare. At first, the left was saying we need Canadian health care, socialized medicine. My wife's Canadian. I know that system. I prefer it. I'm a 100% supporter of single payer. But I knew, and I don't know why the left didn't know, that single payer could not get through the Senate. Did they ever visit the Senate? Did they ever look at the person in charge of the Senate? It's not going to happen. And so I'm glad, relatively, that Obama got an expansion of Medicaid for millions of people who are poor through a system that also profits the industry. And look, it's at stake. It might even go backwards and fall apart. So I credit Obama for achieving certain things that we would not have had before. And on global warming, same argument. You know, like I try to tell 350, I think that pipeline is not going to happen. I don't think you should say it's the be-all and end-all, because Obama's under a lot of pressure. Democrats and Republicans want that pipeline. He's going out of his way to maneuver to put that pipeline off for you guys, and you guys put pressure on, and all that's good. But look at now we have. If you think Obama's the same as the Republicans, are you really saying he's the same as Mitch McConnell? It seems a little goofy to fail to observe these differences. It doesn't mean you can sit back. I never sat back for a second. It doesn't mean you can sit back. You have to keep the pressure on. But it does mean that gaining ground is torture. It's like every inch is sacred to get anywhere in this country. It could get worse so quickly. I think in this next couple of years on these issues, people have to have a more nuanced view of Obama. One final example. Do people who say Obama's the same, same old, same old, do they think there's no difference between Obama and Netanyahu? Do they really? Do you know what's at stake about these negotiations with Iran? Do you know what? How far Obama, with all your criticism, anybody's criticism, how far his neck is stuck out? How many people in both parties are against him? I don't know what they want. War? No, it's worse than that. They don't want to have to vote on it in Congress. They're cowards. So I appreciate the stand he's taking on Iran.
You are now an elder statesman of...
Not a statesman. I'm certainly old.
Well, looking back on a very long and illustrious career of activism and engagement, what would the 70-something Tom Hayden's advice be to the 20-something Tom Hayden?
Oh, to myself? I'm glad you asked that, because I will not give advice as a matter of principle to 20-something other people. I wish that I had been raised in a more political culture. I was proud of being new and having no background. I thought we were really breaking ground and really truly original, which I'm still proud of, but we had to learn everything ourselves. Every book, every event, our history, mine, was erased. Irish Catholic, immigration, dispossession, you know, the works. Growing up in Wisconsin and Michigan, my father for Joe McCarthy, my mother for Adlai Stevenson, I had to learn it all myself. And I think that's why I came close to being part of the dropout generation and the beat generation, but I didn't want to be crazy. And I was saved really by the appearance of people my age who blessed me with the observation that you could live your life for a purpose you were willing to die for. They were my age. They were Chuck McDough. They were Julian Bond. They were Bob Moses. They were Sandra Kaysen. They were all these people who went south. So my advice to myself would be to continue going to the discomfort zones. I may be too old to go to the Southern Africa and fight Ebola, but I'm glad that I was at the university. I had great professors, but I'm even more glad that I followed my instinct to go to Macomb, Mississippi, and to Havana, Cuba, and to Hanoi, North Vietnam, all before I was 25. But I didn't have any advisors. I don't even know why I did it. It was instinct. I think that you sort of have to settle down later, but I'm glad I led a wilder, younger life. On the other hand, being wild is not as ideal, as perfect a lifestyle as perhaps I once thought.
What are you proudest of?
Living this long and being able to have children and grandchildren and to observe that the spread of participatory democracy and to see, despite all the failures of the left, the lack of organization, the infighting, the sectarianism, the feuds, that wave after wave of young people keep coming, whether it's the Ferguson battle or the climate change, which is all the fight about climate change, all led by young people as far as I can see. And it's unstoppable since they don't have a bureaucracy, or how would you stop them? How would you buy them off since all they want is change and it's not spare change? And so this is a law. It's unfortunate that they don't consolidate, that each wave gets so far and then kind of hits the beach. And then you want to look, was anything achieved? Did the shoreline change as a result of our hitting the beach? And if it did a little bit, like the Voting Rights Act, great. If it doesn't, you carry on. But I'm proudest of the fact that there's some instinct in being human that seeks, that aspires to greater things than your parents had. You know, a better world than the one that you were born into. I don't know where that comes from. Does it come from elders? Yes, maybe, but I think it's also something about a human instinct, almost a biological hope, that if you see it in people and you say, God, you know, why are they doing that? They are putting their lives at risk. It's sort of affirming that something that's powerful and human that makes me feel really great about these other people, seeing them in action. You must see it all the time because you see things live, right? And you wonder, God, where the people, how'd they get the guts to do that? Or where'd that idea come from? Wow, I love that. It's creativity. It's creation unfolding is what it really is.
Well, Tom Hayden, thanks for joining us on the Vermont
You're so
Conversation.
Welcome. Thanks. Hello, Vermont.